The Washington Post recently adopted the motto, "Democracy dies in darkness." But democracies can also die in broad daylight. That's what many observers fear is happening in Turkey. On Sunday, Turkish voters narrowly passed a constitutional referendum that revamps the country's political system. The result will concentrate even greater power in the hands of its current president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and it could potentially sound the death knell for Turkey's democracy. For his part, President Erdogan championed the vote as a great victory for Turkey. Here he is speaking to supporters at a rally shortly after the vote.
We have put up a fight against the powerful nations of the world. The crusader mentality attacked us abroad. Inside, their lackeys attacked us. We did not succumb.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his inbox, discuss what he has said he will do, and assess the obstacles and opportunities he could confront. This week, we're talking about Turkey's constitutional referendum.
And with us this week to help examine that is CFR Stephen Cook. Stephen is Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies. He's an expert on Arab and Turkish politics, as well as U.S. Middle East policy. Stephen is also the author of False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East, a book scheduled to be published June 1st. Stephen, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephen, you've been following this referendum closely. In the first piece that you produced after the vote was in, you mentioned Turkey's leadership returning potentially to the days of the Sultan in terms of the authority residing in the presidency now. So for the United States, though, why does this election matter? Why does this outcome matter?
Well, it's very important. If you just look at the map, Ankara, the capital of Turkey, sits at the geographic center of some of Washington's most important foreign policy issues. This is a big country. It has a powerful military. Because of its location and our historic ties to Turkey, Turkey, a longtime member of the NATO alliance, we need to work with Turkey. The outcome of the referendum and the way in which Turks are looking at it threatens to further polarize and destabilize Turkey. That should be a great concern to the United States as it seeks to defeat the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq and seeks stability throughout the Middle East, which is, of course, a very important interest for the United States.
So, Stephen, with that as the backdrop, let's talk a little bit about what the vote was about and what it said. Can you just sort of walk us through what exactly are Turks now going to get given that the constitutional referendum passed?
It's a great question, Jim. And let's go back a little bit and just as a baseline, understand what Turkey's political system looks like now. It's essentially a hybrid parliamentary presidential system. There's a parliament. There is a cabinet of ministers, all of whom are members of the parliament, and a prime minister who is also a member of parliament, and also a president. The president, it's been reported in the media that the president essentially has ceremonial powers. That's not actually true. As it's currently written, the Turkish constitution gives the president some important powers, but importantly, he's supposed to stay above the political fray and act more statesmanlike. What these changes do...
Just be clear, though, the Turkish presidency under the current system is not, let's say, like the American presidency. So while it's not purely ceremonial, it's not fully empowered as you might have in a presidential system.
Although to complicate things just a little bit, since President Erdogan became president in August 2014, he has empowered that office as far as he can go. That's a function of who he is. He had been the prime minister for the previous 12 years, and his charisma has allowed him to empower that office. Now,
and he dominates the majority party in Turkey.
And of course, again, this is informal in his current position because he had to formally resign his position as the chairman of the Justice and Development Party when he moved from the prime ministry to the presidency. So what this change does is it abolishes the post of prime minister, flows all the power from the prime minister to the office of the presidency, and then enhances those powers. So now, for example, if the Turkish president is somewhat less powerful than the American president under a new system, which will come into place after the 2019 general elections, the Turkish president will be even more powerful than the American president. He will have the capacity to issue decrees with the force of law. He will have sole control over judicial appointments.
So unlike in the American system where the president can nominate but then depends upon Congress to, or excuse me, the Senate, to approve those nominations.
Like we just saw with the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right.
President, so there's no check like that. In some sense, the checks and the balances are being taken away.
The checks and balances in the system are either being taken away or they're being blurred. Another prominent example is that under this new system, the oversight abilities of the Turkish Grand National Assembly will be greatly diminished. So this is a very, very big change in the system. It provides the president with sweeping powers. And given the way in which President Erdogan has ruled and has availed himself of authoritarian means to go after his opponents, both real and imagined, those who voted no, approximately half the country, fear that this will deepen Turkey's authoritarianism. Those who voted yes see stability. They see an extension of an era, from their perspective, that has been a progressive one and a democratic one. President Erdogan's core constituency comes from that conservative, middle class, who feel very strongly. They're pious people. And
maybe you should give a little bit of a background quickly about the history of Turkey, the secularist movement under Ataturk, and why that has led to this backlash among the more conservative segment of society.
Thanks, Jim. I think that would be very helpful. Going back to the early 1920s, a guy named Ataturk, known universally as Ataturk, but his real name was Mustafa Kemal.
Father the Turk.
Father Turk is what Ataturk means. Helped forge a Turkish republic out of the Ottoman Empire. And that republic was a clean break from the Ottoman Empire, in which the sultans ruled with both political and religious legitimacy. The new republic was different. It was a secular republican system, unlike the multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic Ottoman Empire. The new Turkey was to be built on an ethnicity, on Turkishness. It became an ethno-national state with a very aggressive kind of secular system. And not secular like you have here in the United States, where the government doesn't infringe on people's expressions of their piety, but a system in which the government controls the expression of piety, at least in the public sphere. The backlash against this has been brewing for a very long time. And when the Justice and Development Party first came to power in 2002, diehard Turkish secularists were very, very worried that this party, led by now President Erdogan, would start undermining the secularism of the Turkish Republic. And his core constituency is this pious, conservative, middle class. Now, I should say that polls show that no more than 10% of Turks want to live under Sharia. The Justice and Development Party, President Erdogan, don't really have a conception of an Islamic state, but they have a conception of a society in which religious values shape people's behavior. And that is what his core constituency has come to enjoy. One of the sources of the Justice and Development Party's success is that over this period of 15 years, where they have been in an unrivaled political situation, has been they have allowed Turks to explore their religious identities in ways that under previous governments would have put these people in jeopardy.
Can you give us an example?
Well, one prominent example, an example that people always point to, is that in state-funded universities and even in private institutions, young women who wanted to wear the Muslim headscarf, the hijab, were not permitted to wear it. Now they can wear it in state-funded institutions. And so for the young woman who wants to express her piety by wearing the hijab, the Justice and Development Party era has been one where her civil rights have been extended and protected. And that's why I think a lot of people, at least half the country, voted for these changes. They see in President Erdogan a protector of their gains and the potential extension of their gains over the course of the last 15 years. It's not just religion. They have more money in their pocket. They're healthier. There is universal health care in Turkey. There are transportation options that people never had before. There is socioeconomic mobility that a certain class of Turks never enjoyed under previous governments. And people have put their faith in Recep Tayyip Erdogan to continue that progress.
Mr. Erdogan has been a big investor in Turkey's infrastructure. He was formerly the mayor of Istanbul, and he's built bridges. I believe he's now building a tunnel that's going to connect Istanbul with European Istanbul.
There's a metro system that's better than the D.C. metro system.
You know, that's not a very high bar.
Well, I'm just trying to bring it home to our listeners.
Well, let's talk about what you mentioned at the outset, which is the neighborhood Turkey's in. This is a troubled neighborhood, to put it mildly. And you didn't mention yet the security situation and the extent to which Turks were concerned about that, because this was raised again and again by Erdogan, talking about whether you talk about the threat posed by Kurdish separatists or terrorists, or whether it's the ISIS threat or just the crush of refugees coming from Syria and so forth. To what extent did that play into the public's mindset in this?
Oh, I think undoubtedly it was an important part of Erdogan's campaign for yes in the referendum, and I think people responded to it. Erdogan hammered away at the idea that these constitutional changes will help bring more stability to Turkey, that the current system was antiquated and inefficient, and that with a president that enjoyed the kinds of powers envisioned in these constitutional changes, that the security situation will improve. And Turks have reason to worry about it. There are multidimensional threats confronting Turkey. There's the threat from the Islamic State. There's the threat from the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known universally as the PKK, a terrorist organization that has been waging war against the Turkish state since 1984. Offshoots of the PKK have been responsible for bloodshed. Going back to mid-2015, hundreds of Turks have been killed in terrorist-related violence. In December 2016, there were 4 terrorist attacks in as many weeks. And Erdogan hammered away, emphasized this idea that these constitutional changes will make for a more secure Turkey.
Can we talk a little bit about the vote itself? Because President Erdogan and his allies were predicting that they were going to get 60% or more yes vote. They only got about 51.7%, and there are a number of allegations that there was vote fraud on industrial scale. So what do we make of the fact that the vote didn't win by as much as predicted and may have
also controlled the media and sort of the whole discussion ahead of the vote as well?
You know, European electoral observers relatively quickly called this vote unfair. And there is enough evidence of questionable electoral practices, I should say, to warrant the opposition parties to demand a recount, to try to seek redress in Turkey's constitutional court, which they will not get. Once the Supreme Election Board in Turkey rules, it's final. They have no standing in the constitutional court. And then their next option is to go to the European Court of Human Rights.
What would happen if that were to be the case?
Nothing. Nothing. President Erdogan, the Justice and Development Party, state television, and now the Electoral Board have certified this election. It's a yes. He got 51.7%. He underperformed, but nevertheless, from his perspective, is a yes is a yes. And in fact, the day afterwards, he told the opposition to basically get over it. The problem is that the country is divided. This is nothing new. But the scale of change that is going to happen in Turkey is so massive and concentrates so much power in the hands of one man that the possibility for instability, protest, contestation at the street level is there. Erdogan has never been magnanimous in victory and will surely go after his opponents as well as those people within the Justice and Development Party that didn't deliver that 60%. He will go after them ruthlessly. There is going to be a night of long knives within the Justice and Development Party, and then he will move on to his opponents outside the party.
Well, and we saw in the run-up to this, we saw very bitter feelings towards European states that, for example, wouldn't allow Turkish officials to campaign to Turks living abroad, the Netherlands, for example, Germany. Really harsh words, harsh language against fellow NATO allies, among other things. The whole European project seems to be pretty much foundering at this point, right, in terms of Turkish, Turkey growing closer to Europe.
You know, Erdogan comes in for a lot of criticism, but he's not solely to blame for the crisis with, for example, the Dutch governments or the German governments. They both had their own leaders in both of those countries had their own electoral concerns for canceling those pro-Erdogan rallies among their Turkish populations and for preventing Turkish ministers and parliamentarians from taking part. Because they have their own politics and their own challenges from the anti-immigrant right in those countries. Of course, Erdogan saw tremendous benefit out of this and deepened the crisis by the harsh words that you've referenced to play to his own nationalist right. And in fact, there is some evidence that some voters who aren't necessarily Justice and Development Party voters voted for yes because they were offended by the way in which the Dutch and German governments responded to Turkish efforts to express their support for Erdogan in Holland and Germany.
We should add that Turkish expats tended to vote yes along the lines of the yes.
They did. They didn't here in the United States, but there was certainly strong yes votes in European countries.
One thing we haven't mentioned is the failed coup attempt last July. Mr. Erdogan has been governing under states of emergency decree ever since then, making it all the more remarkable he only got to 51.7% given his domination of the political system right now. Do we expect that the state of emergency is going to be ended now that the referendum has passed? Is Turkey going to bring other people into the political system, or are we really looking at the rule of the Sultan?
In fact, the Turkish Grand National Assembly, the parliament, extended the state of emergency just yesterday. And I would expect that it will be extended at least one more time, especially as the United States and its Syrian Kurdish allies, whom the Turks regard as terrorists, pursue operations against the Islamic State in Syria and ultimately go after the Islamic State's capital in Raqqa. The Justice and Development Party, but in particular President Erdogan, is unlikely to be pragmatic in victory. People have been waiting for him to be pragmatic in victory for the last 7 or 8 years, and he has never demonstrated that. One thing about Erdogan, he's a master politician. He is a shrewd politician. I have had the opportunity to be in the room with him 3 or 4 times, and really, there is no one better than Erdogan. Than maybe perhaps Bill Clinton is better, but I've never seen anybody better reading a room, tapping into the way people think about themselves and what and how they will respond. He is taking this yes vote, despite the fact that he got 51.7% of the vote, and with perhaps vote rigging on an industrial scale,
a little pushing, a little hand on the scale.
He is going to take that as a mandate, and he is going to continue to rule as that charismatic figure who is the only one who can finish this transformation of Turkey. No new elements will be added or invited into the political arena unless they express their fealty to President Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party's vision for the future of Turkey.
So that tells us what's going to be happening on the Ankara side. Now, what was the reaction here in Washington to the vote?
Well, it was an interesting reaction. It was muted to start, but President Trump did call President Erdogan the day after the referendum and wished him congratulations on his victory. And that puts the United States in some interesting company, since no European or other Western leaders have called President Erdogan. Russian President Vladimir Putin hasn't called President Erdogan, but the leaders of the Palestinian terrorist organization Hamas have issued their congratulations. The government of Djibouti of Turkmenistan, a number of
Sudan,
other,
I think,
a number of countries like that have called or issued congratulations on President Erdogan's victory. So it seemed odd that President Trump would do it, especially with the allegations of European electoral observers and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which the United States is a member of, have questioned the legitimacy of the vote. Nevertheless, my sense is that Trump made that phone call because the United States will accelerate its operations against the Islamic State in Syria in cooperation with the Syrian Kurdish fighting force that the Turks consider to be a terrorist organization. They consider them to be linked, closely linked, at least part of the same organization, at most, with the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And this may have been an effort on the part of President Trump in the White House to mitigate the tension between the two countries as these operations accelerate with the United States working with an enemy of the Turkish state.
And there's so many things going on in Syria, but this one in particular is to once and for all defeat the Islamic State and oust it from its self-proclaimed caliphate capital in Raqqa in northern Syria.
That's right.
Turks are in the neighborhood. Syrian Kurds have been a very strong ally to the U.S. And there's a feeling that that's sort of imminent, that within weeks or maybe months that will fall. But then there's a fallout that everybody's concerned about.
Right. I think people are worried about catastrophic success in Raqqa. But one more point on the American reaction. The president called and congratulated President Erdogan. The State Department issued a much more measured statement, basically saying that and encouraging the Turkish people to work together. If you read between the lines, I think the State Department was saying that we need to do everything possible to try to preserve pluralism in Turkey. I think that's going to be very hard going forward. I think, as Jim asked a few moments ago, I think he is going to rule like a modern day sultan.
Does the United States have any levers to affect that, or should American policymaking just proceed from the assumption that Mr. Erdogan is going to do as he sees fit, and we should just be focused on how to work with him to accomplish our own objectives?
It really depends on what policymakers want out of the relationship with Turkey. Certainly, the Obama administration initially came to office talking about common values and a strategic partnership with Turkey. And it turned out that President Erdogan really didn't share American values. And President Obama began to look at the relationship more in transactional terms and never wanted to rock the boat with Erdogan about what was going on within Turkey because he wanted to preserve Turkey's cooperation and intelligence sharing, use of Turkish facilities as American forces took on the Islamic State. President Trump has already signaled that human rights, democracy is not necessarily a priority for his administration, and that the overriding priority for his administration is the annihilation of the Islamic State. So to the extent that the Turks will cooperate with that, and they've been somewhat reluctant, even though they've been a target, and it's primarily because they have been a target of the Islamic State that they've been reluctant because they don't want more blood running in their streets. And they also believe that the fight will empower their Kurdish enemies. But nevertheless, I think President Trump and the administration are trying to preserve that transactional piece of the relationship. There is an air base in southeastern Turkey called Incirlik that is important to prosecuting the war against the Islamic State because it's so close to Raqqa and Mosul and the areas where the Islamic State are located in Syria and Iraq.
And that base was something that came up again as a point of discussion after the failed coup attempt because there was some concern about the ability to which it could be protected and its assets protected and so forth. Is there any more lingering concern about that, about the integrity of the base and Turkey's role in the post-coup environment?
Well, there were allegations that some of the forces that took part in the failed coup were based at Incirlik Air Base, and therefore U.S. forces must have known what was going on. Those are allegations that have never been proven.
But they certainly play to a part of the Turkish public.
Absolutely. I think that's a fact for many Turks. The status of the base has come up recently because the Turks are quite concerned about American cooperation with the Syrian Kurds. The Turkish defense minister has said, why should we allow the anti-Islamic State coalition to operate out of our bases while they are working with our enemies? There's a very easy answer to that question, is that when President Obama first asked countries for their support and forces to help fight the Islamic State back in the summer of 2014, the Turks balked. They said, we don't like your anti-ISIS strategy. We're reluctant to directly engage the Islamic State because we don't want blood running in our streets. And our priority is fighting Kurdish nationalism. And so this compelled the Pentagon to seek allies elsewhere. And the Syrian Kurds raised their hands and said, we'll fight the Islamic State with you. And the Pentagon has grown used to working with these people. And it is going to continue to be a source of tension between the United States and Turkey. And that's where the base comes in. That's where the base comes in. The Turks see that they have leverage over the United States, not that the United States has leverage over Turkey. And I think that that's the case. On the flip side, if the United States genuinely is concerned about pluralism in Turkey, there's always the presidential bully pulpit about the excesses of Erdogan, the deepening authoritarianism in Turkey. There's always a variety of public ways the United States can express its displeasure. But of course, given the way Turkish politics goes, it's very easy for President Erdogan and other Turkish officials to turn that around on the United States and signal to the Turkish public that here the United States is trying to bring Turkey to its knees when people have just voted in this democratic way for, from their perspective, stability and prosperity.
What is there, on a related note, Stephen, what is there to make of the occasional overtures, the Turkish-Russian overtures? It's been a very interesting relationship to observe. There is some school of thought that says they are gradually and inexorably moving towards a closer sort of realpolitik relationship with Russia. What is your take on that?
I think at its base is a function of the fact that the Obama administration basically excluded itself from the Syria conflict in a variety of ways, particularly in diplomatic and political ways. And so that President Erdogan and the Turks have a problem with the Syrian Kurds and the fact that the Syrian Kurds are making gains and are threatening to knit together some sort of autonomous, quasi-independent type of mini-state, proto-state in northern Syria that is a threat to Turkey. And given that the Russians are the power brokers in Syria, Erdogan had to go to Moscow to try to secure Turkey's interests in Syria. That's a risky proposition for Erdogan on a number of levels, but most important is that the Russians are very good at playing both ends of the stick, and they too have been supporting the Syrian Kurds all along. I think it can only go so far, the Turkish-Russian relationship. The bulk of Turkey's trade and investment flows are to the west. There's trade in agricultural products and energy, but most of the kind of investment that Turkey needs really does come from the west, as well as from the Gulf.
There's also some historical animosity between the Turks and the Russians.
You just anticipated my next sentence, is that, you know, over the course of 800 years, the Russians have been beating the Turks at everything. The Crimean Peninsula was once part of the Ottoman Empire. So the exercise of Russian power in and around Turkey makes the Turks very, very nervous. But Erdogan has no choice when it comes to Syria. He likes to play this Russia thing as a way of trying to get Americans' attention. And there is some opinion out there here in the United States that, you know, Erdogan models himself after Putin and that they're growing closer and that the Turks are no longer committed to the Atlantic Alliance. I think that we may find a day where the Turks may possibly rethink their relationship with NATO, maybe in the same way that the French removed themselves from the Integrated Military Alliance and then came back a number of decades later. But the idea of a kind of Russian-Turkish alliance seems to me more about speculation than anything really happening there.
Stephen, I want to ask you one final question. I want to go back to the issue of the American reaction to the vote in U.S.-Turkish relations more broadly. You've painted a picture, which I think is likely, that the Trump administration is going to approach Turkey, relations with Turkey, in a sort of transactional way. We have a a priority here in Syria, defeating the Islamic State. President Trump has not made human rights, rule of law, democracy a priority, unlike previous presidents, both Democratic and Republican. President Trump has come under some criticism from people here in the United States for not making human rights and democracy a more important priority. And one of the common criticisms you hear from people who want to see the United States say more about democracy and human rights is by failing to do so, you actually end up weakening the forces for democracy and rule of law in countries. And lots of historical examples, American presidents speaking, think Ronald Reagan. Many people in Russia at the time, dissidents, said that the power of Reagan's speeches gave them support, inspired them to persevere under very harsh criticisms. Are we at a risk over a longer term by treating U.S. relations with Turkey in a transactional sense of perversely fueling anti-Americanism in Turkey? Obviously, you're also a student of Egypt, and the United States for many years has backed authoritarian rulers in Egypt. And my sense from our conversations is that there's a fair amount of anti-Americanism in Egypt that is tied precisely to that point. We support people who oppress Egyptians.
I think it's a little different in Turkey than it is in Egypt. In Egypt, among democracy activists and liberals, there is a general outrage. There is, from what they see, is the gap between political institutions here in the United States and our conduct in the world, which leads us to support people like Hosni Mubarak or now Abdel Fattah Sisi, the leader of Egypt. In Turkey, there is somewhat different. And let me just say that Turkish dissidents, those journalists who have been jailed, Turkey is one of the top five jailers of journalists in the world. Someone who I know very well, who's now spent more than 100 days in a Turkish prison, told me that when he met with Vice President Biden in the latter days of the Obama administration, and the vice president met with a number of journalists and academics and other activists who were opposed to Erdogan, it was deeply meaningful to them. And it made them angry when President Obama did not speak out about the conduct of the Turkish state during, for example, the Gezi Park protests, this explosion of popular anger in the summer of 2013. But here's where Turkey is somewhat different. There is a long-term narrative, for lack of a better term, in Turkey about the great powers seeking to undermine the Turkish state. And this comes out of the end of World War I, when the Italians, the Greeks, and the French occupied Anatolia, the area where Turkey now is, and had plans to divide it up. And when the United States has in the past gotten involved in Turkish domestic politics, it has triggered a paranoia about great powers trying to undermine the Turkish state. Think about President Trump speaking out about this now when so many Turks believe that the United States alliance or cooperation with these Syrian Kurds who are regarded as terrorists. Think about how that would play in Turkish politics. It would fuel even more anti-Americanism than there is now. And there is a vast reservoir of anti-Americanism in Turkey at the moment. So it is tricky for the administration. And as I said, my hunch is that President Trump placed that phone call to mitigate the tension over what is about to happen, which is an acceleration of operations against the Islamic State in Syria in cooperation with these Syrian Kurds.
I think you just hit on one of the important lessons to keep in mind about diplomacy and world politics, and that is what you're saying isn't necessarily what people are hearing.
I think that's true.
Well, on that note of caution, perhaps, we will wrap up this episode of The President's Inbox. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Please subscribe to The President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Opinions expressed on The President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick, recording engineer Jonathan Perry, and with special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on The President's Inbox.